You guys, I've been excited to have Jalal on for a while. He is very eloquent in the way he expresses and teaches quantum biology, but I've noticed particularly on his Instagram that he has a spiritual aspect to him. And in my opinion, that is the next step for quantum biology if you want to move the gradient along. And I'm curious, what is your spiritual background and how has it gone in tandem with your awakening to quantum biology? Because I personally awakened spiritually first, and then from that lens, I recognize the importance of that paradigm, because it's very similar. One's just metaphysical and then one's physical, but they have a lot of mirrors. And then I've heard people have it backwards. They implement light, water, magnetism first, and then they're able to recognize the significance of the metaphysics, God, source, all this stuff. So how did that kind of all coalesce for you?
That's a great question to start off with, Kenford. And for me, yeah. I was born a Muslim and have been a practicing Muslim my whole life. And so for me, worshipping God, there only being one God. And obviously in Islam, we believe that Prophet Muhammad was the last prophet. So just following those basics in Islam has been kind of my anchor throughout my whole life. It's been my compass. Not to say that that's the only way, because I do believe that many of us are worshipping the same God, and there's just different ways of expressing the spiritual and faithful side of things, whether that be through the Bible or through the Quran, etc. So that has always been my anchor in life. And definitely for me, it was kind of like a simultaneous approaching where I am right now, not only through the science, but also through the spiritual side of things. And really understanding more recently than say, you know, 12 months ago, 24 months ago, that as it stands right now with my understanding, I believe that the game that we're playing is actually one of alchemy, which is an understanding of, if we talk pure science, alchemy is commonly thought of as like the process where you turn lead or another base metal into gold. Whereas what I feel is really happening is we're turning a leaden soul or a soul that is injured in some way, and turning that into a soul of gold. And so alchemy really marries the spiritual side of things with the science and the physical, etc. So it is kind of like a marrying up of both. That's the journey that I've been on for the last, I guess we're all on that journey from the time we're born. A lot of us just don't know that that is the journey. And quantum biology is a beautiful way of using real science to explain the spiritual and the metaphysical. That's all of a sudden, because of quantum theory, a lot of the stuff which the mystics have spoken about or written about actually holds true. And it's a super exciting time. But I do appreciate more the spiritual side of things as opposed to the scientific side of things. And I think, as you mentioned earlier, that's really where the space needs to go. We need to stop focusing purely on electrons and protons, because I don't believe that the quantum field is the most fundamental, like, initial thing in our reality. Many of us are still stuck in this kind of electrons and protons and all of that, without understanding that there is this, you know, field of consciousness that governs all.
Mm-hmm. Right. I feel the same way. And the space definitely talks a lot about the physical interventions that we can take, and it takes the physical interventions and takes it to their foundational roots. If you're going to do anything physical, you do this, the quantum biology stuff, but you introduce the metaphysical aspect. And I'm familiar with that stuff because that's a lot of what the spiritual space talks about. But I don't hear a lot of people who dabble in both simultaneously. You've talked a lot about the physical interventions a lot in the podcasts that you do, but I want to ask you, this has been the marrying of the two paradigms. How do you yourself incorporate those metaphysical things like the soul alchemy and what that looks like for you and how you treat your patients?
So, I mean, personally, like, I mean, I pray every day, I ground every day. Sometimes I ground for hours. Sometimes I ground only for 20 minutes, you know? If it's a good day of sun quality where the skies are clear, then I'll spend as much time as I can outside. Today, right now, it's 7:30 a.m. in Australia and it's a Monday morning, so I've got a full day of patience, but I'll take opportunities between patients to grab a light break. So, I mean, I just do the basics, and I don't get every sunrise, you know, as controversial as that may sound for someone that's in the space, but it's like, we put ourselves under so much pressure to tick every single box and think that we're almost portrayed as if, like, you're not going to be healthy or you're not going to stay healthy if you don't get every sunrise and if you don't do red light therapy every day. And it doesn't resonate with me, because we mustn't forget the unique ability of our body to store energy at like 5 or 6 different layers within the physical part of our body. We store energy in our water. We store energy in the chemical bonds between atoms. We store energy in the bonds between molecules, and so on and so forth. Like, even within protons, the quarks are joined together by gluons, and we store an insane amount of power and energy within the gluons. And so it's kind of like, you store so much when you go out there to harvest, when you go out in the sun to harvest photons and to, you know, upload electrons from the ground, etc. Like, you're storing so much. It's not a linear thing where, like, you take it in and you're using it straight away. So you don't have to get every sunrise, as long as you're, I guess, doing the thing which I feel is one of the most important, which is blocking the blue light. That's, in my mind, one of the more important aspects, because you're reducing the input of something which is damaging you. And so how does that relate to kind of what I do in general practice as a dentist? I mean, I do a lot of work in the dental space. I've been thinking about a rebrand. Do I call it like dental alchemy or Sufi dentistry or mystics dentistry and stuff? Because we do some pretty weird and wonderful things. But one of the conversations I always have is talking to patients about this concept of artificial blue light being damaging to our eyes, to our health, to our mitochondria, to our circadian rhythms, of course, and then educating them about the importance of safe sun exposure. We live in Australia, a society which has been hammered by the public health messaging about how the sun is, you know, the cause of all cancer, and we all need to be, you know, avoiding the sun with sunscreen and hats, etc. Like, the messaging is quite strong in Australia. So to try and have that conversation with patients who are hearing it for the first time is tricky sometimes. And so it's not so much about, okay, delivering the message in such a way where you're like, it's my way or the highway, this is the only way to do it. But it's like delivering the message with love, trying to get them to just make a small change, and then they come back next appointment and they're like, oh, I really noticed a difference in my sleep quality now that I've just started to get 5 minutes of morning sun. And so that's when you deliver the next message or the next step along the way. So, like, I mean, I don't know if you're on Twitter at all, or X or whatever it's called now, but like, there's a lot of gym bros pushing like all this science, and some of it is the quantum science, and a lot of what they say is true, but the way that they deliver it just lacks so much love and tenderness that it's almost like I just see injured souls within themselves, because they're unable to deliver such an important message without love and care. And it's sad for me. And I guess that's kind of the overarching value that I have in my mind when I'm trying to deliver a message, whether it's directly to a patient, whether it's online, is that, like, I was once you, I am you, we are the same, we are one. And I treat you with love and respect, and obviously I hope for the same in return. And that's how we move this field of consciousness forward, all of us forward.
The way we articulate the message to one another is very important. And yeah, no, some people are fortunate to catch this paradigm right? And if you're going to puff yourself up, you know, puff your chest up and really say this from a pedestal, your own high pedestal, it's a good paradigm that, yeah, of course, it makes sense that you're going to flex that. But I feel that internally it causes some, what you put out, you get back, right? So if you're like putting people down, looking down on people while you're preaching the quantum biology message, you're inflicting metaphysical distortion upon yourself. And that's why, you know, in the space, we really got the physical stuff down as best as we can, but there is a lot of that arrogance that does come back to us reflectively. And you're one of the few that does. I've heard you say this a few times, but say it with love, compassion, and not, and be humble about it, and be grateful that we came across this information rather than prideful. And you cover, we cover both of our bases that way, both in our soul level and on the physical level. So yeah, just love to reflect that back at you. And it's awesome that you're one that explicitly says that.
Thank you. Look, it's not about being right. It's about what is right at the end of the day. More people focus on being right, being the one person that is right, that's sharing an important message. Whereas the knowledge is already out there. Everybody has that knowledge inside of them. We're like, we have to stop seeing ourselves as the healers. We have to stop seeing ourselves as the doctors, and we have to stop, and we have to start understanding that all we are doing is just unlocking the key so that the person can heal themselves, which is a big step away from like the Western paradigm of care, where it's like, okay, the doctor or the healthcare clinician is like God almost, in terms of they're making the calls, they're deciding the drugs, they're deciding the dosages, they're deciding when to start, when to stop, all these types of things. Whereas if you work with the body's natural intelligence, then modality that the body uses to help heal itself will be used with perfect amounts, with perfect dosages, the perfect dose of, you know, melatonin is released by the body, et cetera, et cetera. So all we have to do is just help the patient find the signal, and then they'll take care of the rest.
Mm-hmm. We plug in, we get aligned, and then the power of nature does it for us, and we don't do the correcting itself. It's nature's power. So that already by itself is a cause for humility rather than pride, because you're not even the one correcting yourself. It's just nature doing it for you once you've aligned with it. So of course, yeah, very, just wanted to get that piece out there, because the spiritual space, the spiritual aspect to this quantum space, there's very much needed marrying for it, but that'll come in its own time, right? As for the physical interventions, do you agree that the 80-20 of quantum biology is the blocking the blue light aspect? Would you say that's generally accurate?
Yeah, I would say the two most important changes that people need to make, which are going to move the needle tremendously, is blocking that artificial blue light, particularly after sunset, but I do it all day. I mean, I'm not wearing glasses at the moment, but I've got the software which blocks the blue light from the screen. But then on the other side, it's that morning sun exposure. And it doesn't even need to be at sunrise. Like, even if you catch the UVA rise, or even if you're just out, like, cause, you know, I mean, how many people are we helping who can't wake up at 6 a.m. in the morning because they're so tired, because they're so low on energy, et cetera. And they've got 3 children, and they've got to drop them to school and get their breakfast and their lunch and all those things ready. Like, we have to be real. And they don't have any help. They might be single mother or husbands working in a different county or a different state for 2 weeks of the month, et cetera. So like, there's a lot of factors to consider. So if you think about what are like the biggest bang for your buck kind of interventions, I would say it would be those to start the day with, trying to get as much morning sun, even if it is after you drop the kids off to school. And then at the end of the day, you could definitely got to block that blue light.
Mm-hmm. Right. That's one thing I really want to hammer in this episode. With Dr. Max Gulhane, I dedicated the whole episode to sunlight and skin cancer, and he just fleshed that out for the entire duration. But, you know, that's sunlight. That's another aspect. For blue light, I also want to do something similar here, because when you think about the dosage of blue light we're all getting, coupled with the inappropriate times that we're getting it, and then you think at the same time, how light is the fundamental driver and a key signal of how we work, it kind of blows my mind at how people will not bat an eye to it. And I didn't bat an eye to it for 22 years. And I feel like it's a critical message to just really hammer home. In Dr. Cruz's podcast with Andrew Huberman, Dr. Cruz mentioned blue light, and Andrew didn't seem to think too much of it, you know, and Andrew, from what I have seen, still doesn't wear the glasses, and he'd be a great proponent to publicly speak about it. And so it's just, I feel like the message hasn't been emphasized as much as it could be. It's very clear for the quantum biology space and those who already know, for the average person who isn't privy to this stuff. Could you, this is the art of science, right? Painting a story in a way that is communicable to the layperson. Could you lay out that blue light story that really contextually puts it in its right context so that people just have their informed consent? If they know what's being done, what's happening to them, then they will have the decision. They'll have yes or no. Let's do this intervention. Let's not. At least they have the option. Whereas a lot of people just don't have the option because they just don't know about it. But we need that information in the first place. So yeah, if you want to take that blue light story and just, as you would put it, as how you would describe it, lay it out, flesh it out in all its veins and stuff.
Blue light glory.
Yeah.
So we have to first rewind and understand and appreciate what is the most important commodity that we have in our lives. And I think it's safe to say we'd all agree that that commodity is time, because we are running out of time. We can't get time back. Although, you know, life is temporary. There is an eternal life that awaits all of us. So time is really of the essence. That's really where it's all at. And so the way that I like to explain it is, if you imagine the economy that we have, there's an exchange of goods and services that is happening. You know, someone comes to me, I clean their teeth, I exchange a service, they reimburse me for that. And so we're using money to determine value for various goods and services. And money is essentially information that is conveying to me how much people think that my checkup and clean service costs, et cetera, et cetera. But another key part of information is that concept of time within our economy. And so I've got an appointment at 1 p.m. with John Smith, for instance. But what if John Smith's clock tells a different time? What if his clock tells, is 1 hour behind mine or 1 hour ahead of mine? What if everyone's clocks in the economy are operating at different times? It would be absolute chaos. It would be absolute mayhem. So that's what's happening inside our body, because we have 100,000 biochemical reactions that are happening every second. 100,000 biochemical reactions happening inside each of our cells every second, and they have to be timed to perfection. So now let's understand how does time actually work inside of our physical body. And the key central controller of time is the suprachiasmatic nucleus, which is a small part of the hypothalamus, which sits right behind the eye, and it's called the eye clock or the circadian clock. And it basically tells time based off the blue light of the sun. And so the blue light of the sun changes throughout the day. It starts off low and then it peaks up at solar noon, and then it comes back down to zero. And the strength of the blue light at solar noon is about 5,500 Kelvin, which is a measure of brightness. The problem is that we are exposing ourselves to artificial lights that are of the same brightness, the same lux, 5,500 or more, but we're exposing ourselves to that light all throughout the day, not just at solar noon. We're exposing ourselves to that light in the morning, in the middle of the morning, in the evening, before we go to bed. So what are sources of those artificial blue lights? Well, it is phones, it's tablets, it's computers, it's televisions, it's ceiling lights at home. It's oncoming traffic, the headlights of oncoming cars. It's going to the local grocery store. It's everywhere. Everything that's lit up, street lights, for instance. And so all of these things are pushing on us a specific wavelength of light between 460 to 480 nanometers, which is instrumental in telling our body what time it is. But they're telling our body that it's solar noon when we're looking at our phone at 7:30 p.m. or when we wake up and the first thing we do is look at our phone. And so what that does is it scrambles the concept of time inside of our body, because it's 7 a.m. but we think it's 12 p.m. And when you do that over and over and over again, what happened is you increase the periodicity of the circadian clock. And what I mean by that is that you increase the speed at which the circadian clock comes back to midnight, so to speak. So to go through 24 hours, it takes less and less time. And that's how you hurtle towards death, quite literally, because you're using up time faster. So this whole blue light story is primarily about circadian rhythms, because when your body loses a sense of time, or when the body's sense of time gets scrambled, then all of the processes that happen inside of the body, such as the release of cortisol in the morning, the release of melatonin at night, the release of leptin, all of these things, they get the 100,000 biochemical reactions that are happening inside our cell every second. All of these things start to become chaotic, which in health terms we would call inflammation. And what we have is a breakdown in the metabolic process. So it's fair to say that circadian dysfunction, in my mind, is the bedrock of all chronic Neolithic diseases in the physical body, because they lead to metabolic dysfunction within the mitochondria, which then leads to a breakdown in the bioenergetics of the cell. And so the cell can't then perform the job of creating energy, transferring energy and information, and signaling to other cells and other tissues within the body that this and this is going on, etc. The spiritual side of blue light is probably my more favorite side of blue light, and that is its effect on our non-visual photoreceptor. Okay, because we have this entire like system inside our body which has got the visual photoreception, so that like the rods and cones in your eyes that allows you to see different colors, green, red, blue, etc. And a combination of red, green, and blue allows us to see like 5 million different colors in nature. So like we've got receptors in our eyes, red, blue, and green cones, which are able to pick up those three colors. And then we've got the rods, which pick up the black and the white and the shadows and everything like that. So the blue light degrades those photoreceptors, which affects our ability to see color properly. But that's your visual photoreception. So it's like it's your ability to literally see things using your eye. But what people don't appreciate is that inside of our body, there's like a much, much bigger bank of non-visual photoreceptors. And that is really where another key part of the damage of blue light is done, because it degrades all of these photoreceptors. So examples of these photoreceptors are things like a lot of the neurotransmitters and hormones that you know everyone in health is talking about, like dopamine. Like dopamine has a peak absorption of 270 nanometers, which is in the UVC range. We have melatonin, which has a peak absorption of 280 nanometers. We have leptin, which has a peak absorption of 220 nanometers, or maybe it's 200. I can't recall exactly. I definitely know it's in the UVC range and well into the UVC range. The water inside of our body picks up infrared light, and that's a frequency of light which we can't see. Vitamin B12 is also a photoreceptor. Heme is a photoreceptor. So the heme and hemoglobin, there's three receivers for red light. There's one receiver for UV light. The mitochondria are full of UV light receptors. That's on cytochrome 1. And then the fourth and fifth proteins are red light receptors. So I'm just plucking examples here to show that like pretty much our entire body is full of non-visual photoreceptors. So like the visual photoreception is perhaps, you know, 1% or less than 1% of what we actually see. Whereas our entire body has got like, it's got water, it's got molecules, it's got atoms, all of these things that are picking up frequencies of light that we can't see, which marries up with the science, because we can only see 0.0035% of the entire electromagnetic spectrum. So there's a lot that we can't see. And we have melanin inside of us that's able to capture all frequencies of light. And what this excessive blue light does is it destroys and degrades these non-visual photoreceptors. And what the main reason it does it, and the main reason that it also upsets the circadian rhythm, is the fact that the artificial blue light is not balanced by red light, whereas any of the blue light that you see in the sun is always going to be balanced by an equal amount or more of red light. And so when you're getting this imbalanced artificial blue light, usually it's about 85% of the light is blue in the screens, in the ceilings, etc. It degrades the non-visual photoreceptors, which then I feel degrades our ability to live a spiritually fulfilling life, because we lose connection to source, we lose connection to reason, we lose connection with love. and we lose the ability to be our best selves and to make the right decisions for ourselves and our family. And that then leads to the brain fog. That then leads to the mental the mental laziness, so to speak, the narcissistic tendencies, the rejection of change. All of these types of things are injured souls, as far as I'm concerned. And I say that with love, because we're all born with some sort of injury to our souls, I feel. And, you know, like that we can take on entities. I've seen it personally, like in my practice, you know, and that's a bit woo-woo, but it's legit. We've suffered from either societal programming, parental programming, family, culture, all these types of things. Some of the stuff we've been taught at school, education, all this stuff is programming us and it's injuring our souls. And when you layer on the light aspect of things, it's no wonder that we're struggling to, many of us, to find the truth. You and I talking right now in the way that we're talking is a miracle in itself, because to still have beings of awareness around, despite everything that's being thrown at us, fluoridated water, all the and especially the blue light, as I've just touched on, it's like, how can it possibly be that, you know, we still have people that are able to transcend what has been thrown at us? And at the end of the day, that's when you have to move out of the physical and move back into the metaphysical. It says some people were born for this time.
Yeah, that's a grace. Absolutely. I was raised in a blue lit environment, lived most of my life in San Antonio, which is a pretty high population density. Spiritual awakening managed to take place despite of all that. It wasn't of my choice. It was an insight that just happened at the right moment where my soul cracked open. From that, receptivity was born. And what you were touching on is, if someone is, I like to look at the body like the radio and the spiritual soul like the station. There's two component aspects that are very much working together concurrently. If you have the physical with the blue light, EMF, water, fluoride in it, that distorts the radio itself. But if you have a lot of trauma, you're closed off, your soul is injured, that will also block off your receptiveness. And a lot of people have a combination of those two. And that's why when, you know, you're telling someone off on Twitter and they just can't get it, that's why they probably can't get it. They can't hear you. The receptiveness just isn't there. And I've had to temper my expression because I've learned, okay, they just can't hear me at this point. You know, they have a lot of stuff going on internally. Like Dr. Cruz said, and you're saying a different aspect of this. If you have low dopamine, you can't see the truth. If you have low melanin, can't connect to source, which I think is very interesting, that if melanin takes in all frequencies, it would be the interface with the spiritual energy that would allow you to take that in as well. It's a very interesting concept that melanin is that interface, which is cool. But yeah, I love to hear that. Very important. And I want you to touch on other veins, such as blue light, raising blood glucose, lowering your dopamine levels. This thing is, I want to touch on this too. Gym bros will think that you can out-exercise, out-eat, and out-supplement it. But like you laid out, going back to your economy analogy, you can load that thing with the best goods, have the best currency and supply. But like you said, if the coordination and communication of it is all off, it doesn't matter what goods you have in the economy. It doesn't matter what currency you have in the economy. It's still going to be trashed. The efficiency just won't be there. And that's how I tie back the diet aspect with the blue light, because it's more foundational in its way. If you want to say something about that.
Yeah. I mean, like you've kind of answered that, your question about the gym bros, in terms of the systems lacking the coordination of the resources. But at the end of the day as well, what blue light does is it degrades the mitochondrial cytochrome. I think definitely 4 out of the 5 are degraded by blue light, if not all of them. And so that means that mitochondria can't produce ATP, but more importantly, mitochondria can't produce water. And so what we have is dehydration inside the cells. And so the gym bros, how did that look? That looks like injuries. That looks like recurrent injuries. That looks like, you know, ligaments being, you know, torn or strained continually. And I see that, you know, there's like young guys who are in their late 20s, early 30s, friends of mine, etc., who should have no reason to be experiencing or struggling with the injuries or the recurrent injuries that they have, whether it be like a knee meniscus or an ACL or something like that. And it boils, and I say it to them all the time, it's because you guys train in blue light and you don't get any sun or grounding, and your skin is super pale, and it's like your system is dehydrated. And so obviously when something is dehydrated, it lacks the lubrication that's required in order for it to function properly. So eventually it's going to tear or it's going to rip. You know, so, I mean, that's it's a good point you raise about, you know, trying to do the healthy things, trying to do physical exercise, trying to eat the right things. But if you don't get the concept of time right, then nothing else really matters. And yeah, to extend that point about dopamine and what blue light does to that, I mean, the blue light comes in through the eye and it activates dopamine inside of our central retinal pathways, which then amplifies that electrical signal throughout the entire brain. Dr. Cruz has said, and many of the physical things that I've learned about quantum biology, I've learned from Dr. Cruz, so I do want to credit that. The dopamine also donates electrons to DHA, which is the key kind of conductor of electricity inside of us, as well as melanin, of course. But so that's one of the things that dopamine does, and it's been shown that blue light directly into the eye and on our skin is degrading the dopamine inside of our body. So that obviously affects your mood, it affects your sense of reward, and so then you constantly will go and seek more dopamine because your dopamine levels are going down. So that fuels the addictive behavior. So one way of kind of reducing addiction is to actually get away from blue light, because getting away from the blue light allows us to normalize our dopamine levels and sync them with nature. But yeah, I mean, from a metabolic sense as well, the kind of the leptomelanocortin pathway is really critical in terms of its interplay with the blue light as well, because we have leptin being released from the subcutaneous fat just underneath our skin, and it does that at about midnight if someone's circadian rhythm is good. And then the leptin goes and acts on neurons inside of the hypothalamus tells them to start releasing POMC. And the POMC then gets cut up by the blue light into ACTH, which is the adrenal corticotropin hormone. And that travels down to the adrenals to result in the release of cortisol. As a direct exposure of blue light into the eye, we have the production of ACTH, which then goes down to the adrenals to increase the release of cortisol. So blue light is increasing cortisol. It is also increasing blood insulin. Dr. Cruz has spoken about how there is another kind of cleavage product of the POMC peptide, because POMC can be cleaved into like 6 or 7 different types of proteins. One of them is ACTH, alpha MSH is another, so it's beta gamma MSH. But another one is called CLIP, which so when the blue light reaches POMC, it can literally cleave that POMC into this CLIP protein, which increases your blood insulin levels. And so if we marry that to what I just spoke about with the cortisol going up, when the cortisol goes up as a natural response, our body increases blood glucose. And then because of CLIP, our blood insulin is increasing as well. So we start to feel this diabetes epidemic that we see in current society, where diabetes is, yes, there's definitely dietary issues at play with diabetes, or nutritional issues at play, but there's also a light issue which is completely ignored. And so how can we expect to move the needle long term for patients if we're not looking at the light issue? I mean, I've had many doctors say to me that I've been able to reverse diabetes in several patients, and I commend them for that. But if they want that long-term result, they need to educate their patients about the blue light aspect of things. Otherwise, eventually it's going to catch up with them.
Mm-hmm. You just touched on something that I've noticed as well. If a doctor, functional medicine doctor or something, has success with a dietary intervention, they'll cap it there, not intentionally, but if they stick with what works, and obviously, you know, net positive, right? We're not denying that. But if you bring up blue light, they kind of hold on to the success of diet. They don't push all the way, which I don't understand why, because it'll only benefit your patient to incorporate the blue light mitigation and blockage. And so it's kind of, there's not even just the average person, it's the doctors too. or it's the practitioners, because I have found resistance when trying to communicate the biophysical aspects, the biophysical interventions. They'll stick to the basic rudimentary stuff, but not encompass this too. Yeah, that's been strange in my opinion, but I'm sure you've experienced that as well, you know, putting forth this information to your fellow physicians, and there's just been this wall. I don't know if you have, but
look, I have. It's upsetting at times, but it's part of the process. And I feel the reason that there is a wall is because we have physicians that are used to kind of having full control of the situation. They're used to having tools at their fingertips. So when you start to talk about blue light, etc., the physicians start to become a lot less involved in the delivery of the treatment. Plus, more importantly, it requires like an immense amount of study to really come across, to get across the science of it all. Let's face it. I mean, these physicians have studied years. To their credit, they work super, super, super hard. They've, you know, jumped through hoops of rings of fire in order to get to where they are right now. And they're succeeding in their careers. They're succeeding financially. They're providing for their families. And so now we've just got a new group of people that are coming to them saying, majority of what you know is incorrect, and this is what's actually correct. And then they're going to be like, well, show me the science. And we're like, more than happy to show you the science, but it's going to take you like 6 months of, you know, study to be able, without any work, just straight study for you to get across the science. And they're like, well, I don't have time for that. And we understand why they don't have time for that, because they're busy living their lives, etc. So it's like, how are they going to make that big jump? And so it is unfortunately the way it is, but luckily this type of stuff, you don't need a physician to deliver the care. It's just about education. And that's where I think a grassroots approach to education, going directly to the people rather than going to the clinicians, is much more powerful, which then comes back to, okay, that whole message about we need to deliver the information we love, because we're talking to so many people that are struggling, that are fighting hard, that are surviving. They're not thriving. And if you come hard at them and, you know, punch them in the face type thing with you, with the way that we deliver the message, then it's just going to go in one ear and out the other. And do we really want to be delivering information to people that are already part of the choir, where we're just singing to the choir? Or do we really want to be delivering information to people that have never heard this before and are just like, oh my God, this just sounds amazing, I'm going to go home and do this now with my kids? For me, it's the latter. I don't necessarily thrive on likes and followers and all that type of stuff. It's more about, you know, how many people can I reach that are not in my, or are not on my side. That's the harder way, but it's the right way.
Mm-hmm. Once you, the lives influenced is the key metric. It's not the followers or the likes. Once you get even one life influenced, then I'm sure you know, like, it's the most addicting thing in the world, the most rewarding thing in the world. To serve someone in that capacity, it's awesome. And another aspect to the blue light story that is related, blue light is bad because of what blue light itself does, right? You know, when you're exposed to it a lot and you're exposed to it at night, but it's also harmful in the sense of what it's absent in, of the red light and the infrared light. So if you can add these puzzle pieces to the story, why is it that a UV light deficiency in the light bulbs we're surrounded by is bad? Like, what is that? What are the implications of that? And then the red light as well. It's a big story, but it'll make this more all encompassing for sure.
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, this red light, this infrared light, it's naturally occurring in the sun. The sun is 43% red light. So whenever we see the sun, most of the color that we see is red light or stuff in the red light spectrum. So the infrared, near and far, etc. The key thing about the red light is it's balancing out the blue light. In addition to that, it is helping to increase mitochondrial ATP and water production because of red light's action on the fourth and fifth proteins within the mitochondrial electron transport chain. So that's a way to rehydrate your body because your body starts to produce more water. It is also something which is good at structuring the water that your mitochondria are producing. And so by structuring, we literally mean creating some sort of order and coherence to the water, because there's water that we drink, which is like a liquid that's called bulk water. But then there's also a fourth phase of water, a different phase of water, which lines all the proteins inside of our body, all the DNA inside of our body, and that's called exclusion zone water. And so most of our body is exclusion zone water. This bulk water, this liquid water, turns into exclusion zone water upon being exposed to red light and infrared light. And so it is absolutely key that we have that source of red light and infrared light, which we get from the sun, of course. But these artificial sources of light that we use to illuminate our lives are absent of the red light. And so something which has been around for a while and is quite powerful is red light therapy, because it is an artificial way of delivering this red light information that your body requires. Yes, to damage from the blue light, etc., but also to help rehydrate the system and repair the photoreceptors. Red light and infrared light has a huge key role in the production of melatonin. And melatonin is one of the key molecules that helps to repair the photoreceptors that have been degraded by the blue light. So we've got kind of this blue light, which has got two phases. It's good because it tells our body time, but it's bad because it can lead to degradation of the photoreceptors inside of our body, the visual and the non-visual. But then in nature, it's always balanced by the red light to deal with the dark side of blue light, so to speak. And to negate or mitigate all the bad effects that the blue light can have on us. So that's really, the main part of the story of the red light and the infrared light. It's the ability to charge separate water. It's the ability to increase hydration, reduce inflammation via the mitochondria, and its ability to help repair these photoreceptors as well, which is absolutely critical. There's one thing as well, which I'd like to just quickly mention, is that the more blue light you have, the more DHA you should have. And so the DHA is omega-3 fatty acid that's found in seafood. And all of our photoreceptors that have DHA inside of them. So when you have, photoreceptors inside of you that are being degraded by blue light, if you can at least negate that by having more seafood, because that helps to repair your photoreceptors.
And then when you don't have any UV light in your environment, you won't make melanin as much, which is also important part of this story, tying back to the dopamine addiction, all that, and bioenergetics, right? Can you touch on that vein as well?
Yes, sure. So when we get UV light into our eyes, it travels via the central retinal pathways to the neurons inside of our hypothalamus and results in that production of POMC, which we touched on earlier. And the UV light can cleave the POMC into something called alpha MSH, which is alpha melanocyte stimulating hormone, which then produces melanin throughout our body. And so we don't just have melanin on our surfaces like the eyes and the skin, but it also lines the gut, which is the internal external surface, so to speak. But it's also able to travel between the layers. It's able to travel between the deep tissues inside of the body, such as the substantia nigra, which is a Parkinson's disease. That's where it's commonly known for, that part of the brain, but also able to travel from those deep layers to the surface and back. So melanin is kind of like this wonder molecule that is able to trap, it's made by UV light, but once it's made, it's able to trap UV light and use that UV light to split water into molecular hydrogen, which is the most powerful antioxidant inside of us, molecular oxygen, which is the terminal electron acceptor inside of the mitochondria, plus electrons. And electrons is like the currency that we use in our body's internal economy to function. This powerful role of melanin and UV light is central to really how our body works at a quantum thermodynamic level. Because when I say quantum thermodynamics, I don't just mean like the thermodynamics and the efficiency of like the physical processes that are happening inside of our body, But that quantum, that word refers to the information that is applied to a thermodynamic system in order for it to operate at top efficiency. And that information is time, which isn't just blue light. It's UV light. It's infrared light, because all light is time for us in some way or another. UV light has that role to play with melanin. It has a huge role to play in activating a lot of the hormones and molecules inside of us, like dopamine, where that UV light is stored within the dopamine and then all the melatonin, and then that UV light is released later on or at another time of the day. So that's another powerful aspect to UV light. And then this is a not so well known aspect of water, but once water is charged, separated into easy water and this bulk water, and once we've got this gel-like fourth phase of water that we that has been formed, now that it's no longer a liquid, it's a gel, light passes through it differently, it refracts differently. So then its actual peak absorption is no longer in the red infrared range, it's actually in the UV range. And so that amplifies the number of electrons inside of the exclusion zone water. So water is all about first getting that morning sun with the infrared light, with the red light, to charge, separate the water. And once we have this exclusion zone, now it's prepped and ready for the UV light later on in the morning, which amplifies the amount of electrons that is in the exclusion zone water. So that increases your charge. I mean, UV light is also critical for slowing down the mitochondrial electron transport chain, because it results in the release of nitric oxide. Nitric oxide acts on the fourth cytochrome. Sorry, I'm getting technical.
Oh, go for it.
And that stops the electrons. When you have the nitric oxide released, it sits on that cytochrome 4 and stops the flow of electrons coming through. So like electrons can't get to oxygen now. So we're slowing down the production of energy inside the cell from electrons, but we still have the red light of the sun that's still able to activate cytochrome 5, which is the ATPase. And so we're able to still produce ATP and able to still produce water. And so we have this powerful thing of, when you're in the sun where there's a lot of UV light, you have less need for food, because your body's not producing energy from food. Your body's producing energy from light, from the red light of the sun. That's why when we're at the beach, we're not as hungry. So that's another cool thing of UV light. And what does that mean for cell replication? I mean, if we're slowing down mitochondrial energy production, isn't that tying in with cell replication? Because we know that all needs to slow down for the cell to be able to divide and do its thing. And then once it's divided, then mitochondrial energy production gets wrapped up again. So strong correlation between UV light being, like, having adequate amounts of UV light inside of our body and the cell cycle and cancer and all that type of stuff. Not to say that it's an absolute cure, because I still believe that there's always emotional and metaphysical aspects to cancer. On the same token, we can always help ourselves in the physical realm.
Mm-hmm. I know people who have loved ones with cancer, and they will employ all kinds of woo treatments. It works in the metaphysical sense, right? But I'd ask them, how's their light environment like? And it's kind of, it brings up a wall, because I'm putting forth a physical intervention to the person who is more spiritual and stuff, but I want to cover all bases. You know, there's, of course, you don't want to be fearful of every single thing, but nature herself is supportive, right? If you connect to nature, she is supportive and will support you in your metaphysical endeavors and healing. I love that you touched on that, right? There is, I believe, too, an emotional unseen portion of cancer, right?
People need to appreciate that, like, our body is like, it's not just a physical body, and it's not just a soul body. There's like multiple levels to it. Like, if you read a book called The Quantum Doctor by a gentleman called Dr. Amit Goswami, he talks about how there's like 5 different layers to the body. There's like the physical body. Then above that is the vital body, which is like your Ayurvedic chakras or your traditional Chinese medicine, pressure points. And the vital body has no physicality to it. You can't see it. If you are working through a cadaver and doing a dissection, you're not going to find the meridian points. You're not going to find the meridian channels or the chakras, but they're there. Then above that, you've got the mental body, which is your mind, and your mind's body ability to control your body. And then above that, you have, he calls it the supramental body, meaning above the mental body. To keep it simple, we can call that the soul. And then the final body, so to speak, or the fifth level is the bliss body, which is your soul's connection to source or to consciousness or God. And so we've got five different layers to the body. And if we are to just focus on one or two when we're ill, it's sometimes missing out on important levels where there could still be blockages. And the physical body is still critical, and using physical modalities to help with metaphysical issues. There's no reason why we can't lean on that. It's there for a reason, you know. But at the same time, sometimes purely just doing the physical without talking at the metaphysical side of things is going to result in, like, you know, sometimes going around in circles and not really making progress.
Why do you think that is, that we can't just treat the body like, not in the sense of in general, why do you think the universe is that way, where just purely physical intervention won't work all the time and you need that metaphysical aspect? Because if you have this physical meat suit, that physical meat suit needs free will, right, to express, and that free will could be distorted and going awry. And so I think the creator just used that metaphysical aspect of disease to cover that basis, because you could be an asshole and all you have to do is be out in the sun and there's not going to be love spread, right? So I wonder what your take on that is and how you see that, how those work to, though, how the, that two works together.
What? It's because the physical realm is not fundamental to our reality. That's why purely doing physical work in health is not going to result in whole body. So like, what's fundamental to reality isn't even electrons and protons and light. It's still this field of consciousness that, that has all the possibilities within it, and where God decides what possibility you embody on a daily basis. Obviously, then you chuck in, as we've touched on, the societal programming of family and trauma and all that type of stuff. Then it and the blue light, it injures the soul, it degrades the photoreceptors, so that your ability to tap into all the possibilities within this realm of consciousness, it's limited. You can't get access to as many possibilities. So you're living a more restricted life. And the physical body is, or dis-ease within the physical body is an expression of some sort of blockage or breakdown in the bodies that are higher up, whether that is the vital body with the acupuncture, whether that is the mental body with the brain, whether that is the soul, or whether that is the soul's connection to consciousness. And so, like, I mean, a little while ago, I posted a new concept in my mind, although maybe it's already been out there, but the idea of a primary care metaphysician, whose role is to work out at what level that person is blocked, or what levels, and then prescribing various treatment modalities or practices to help clear those different levels so that the expression within the physical body can improve. Sometimes that just means a bit of acupuncture. Sometimes it means, you know, seeing a shaman. Sometimes it means, you know, going to Mecca if you're Muslim. So it just depends on the person, on their on what issues they struggle with, and personalizing the care to them, because it's not just sun and blocking blue light. There's this whole other realm, which is scary. It took me ages to really wrap my head around it. You know, fumbled my way through, like, asking, well, what is consciousness, for a long time, not really understanding what it was. And that's where I think the science was nice, because it was able to really explain to me, at least give me some sort of an idea of what consciousness is. Can we ever really answer that question entirely? Or definitively, probably not. It's probably something that man has been trying to do for eons, and will never get there. Much like love, perhaps they're the same thing.
How do you? Of course, we can't answer what is consciousness. That's limiting something that is unlimited, undefinable. What was your thought process in graduating from? You always had the religious background, of course, but how do you yourself see okay, there's this quantum thing, electrons and protons, but what is your reasoning as to why that can't be it? Like, that's not the main thing, your personal process past that, you know?
I see. When I came to understand that there is like this intelligence, this field of possibilities that is God's intelligence, and out of that, they collapse into one through what is called the observer effect in quantum theory. You have all these possibilities, but they collapse into you and I talking right now. Like, I could be talking to someone else. I could be talking to no one, but you and I are talking right now. So it's one possibility out of like an unlimited field of possibilities. And so we're talking by design. It is God's will. When I understood that concept of the observer effect, where you have unlimited possibilities on this wave, which delineates all the possibilities in the quantum field. And then when you see something and all the possibilities collapse into that one thing, so this is the double slit experiment, it was kind of like science's way of saying that, okay, well, we definitely have this universal field of intelligence, of possibilities, etc. So the cool thing as well is then how does that translate into the reality that we see? Like, I feel that consciousness uses light to tell space-time how to bend. Light is an instrument of consciousness. It is not consciousness. And it follows from there that, like, the most fundamental particles that form matter or space-time, they are also instruments of consciousness. So that aspect of things, really, it was the observer effect was like the turning point for me. But then if you and I are standing next to each other and we both see a tree, okay, then could it be as well that there is a, like, there is already an observer that has collapsed all the possibilities into the space-time that you and I live in? And could that observer be God? That's what I hold. That's what I believe to be true.
Very much so. When you dive into quantum biology, that's what I saw, just fractals and levels. And when I was digesting this question, if you took Jack's work, you made him immortal, and you made him figure out every little pattern in physicality, and he deduced every single detail in the material universe quantum mechanically, there's still the question, okay, but how do these processes themselves aren't life, right? They're, you know, it's a process. It's not a person. Like, that electron moving here or there isn't alive in of itself. And then you stack up all these inanimate processes, and then it somehow coalesces into a live being, where is that switch? Like, can inanimate matter get so complex that it reaches this new dimension called life? Or can you make something inanimate and make it animate just by making it more complex? In my opinion, no, because that's just because it's complex doesn't mean it doesn't solve the basic problem of it's still inanimate. Something must have preceded the inanimacy of it. And you touched on it. Consciousness uses these processes as its instrument to express, right? So there's like this bottom-up theory, whereas you and I believe, are on the same page of life itself is primordial, and it uses these processes to express in 3D space-time.
Yeah. I completely agree. Life is primordial. The electromagnetic spectrum is the instrument that's used to determine if that life remains animate or whether it becomes inanimate.
Instruments. Yeah. Well said. Another analogy I like to use is, if number is a product of the principle of infinity, like, number doesn't end. There's infinite forms of it, but number never stops. You can keep going and going and going, but there's always that pool of infinite possibility is primordial that was there before the physical expression, which for number, for infinity, it'd be the individual numerations of it. So that's just, you know, in mathematics, and you get into that rabbit hole. But yeah, I feel like it's an important conversation for the quantum biology community to have, because it recontextualizes what we all learn. You appreciate God's creation more. What we see and what we learn through the blue light, the physics, it's God's mind in action. It's amazing to watch.
100%.
Yeah. Can you briefly talk about your clinical experiences over applying this quantum biology stuff? Because I had a friend who had certain diseases like diabetes and all this stuff. And I was telling her, like, yeah, in this paradigm, that stuff is resolvable. And she looked at me kind of like, that's a bold statement. And I understand, because, you know, conventional medicine, yeah, it's impotent to resolve those chronic diseases. But I'm sure you've experienced in your clinical practice, whether it's in there in Australia or the clients you take over the internet, that no, these basic principles do move the needle quite a bit. And I'm just curious how that's shown itself to you in your life with the people you work with.
Yeah, sure. It's been like wins and no wins, you know. So like, which has really forced me to dig deeper as a clinician, because, you know, you have wins where you're able to help a young woman change her lifestyle so that she's able to have children and end her infertility journey, so to speak, you know. So like that, incredibly rewarding. But you've had other instances where, like, you know, there's been like a gentleman that's had some gut issues, which just can't resolve just by, you know, having a diet that's, you know, healthy, seasonal, it's local, doing all the right things from a quantum perspective, but he's got a blocked solar plexus, which is his third chakra. So, and that, you know, that could be equating to ages, you know, 14 to 21 in his life. That could be a concept of personal power, a whole host of things. So like all of these, this work that I've been doing and have done, is like, there's definitely been successes, but there's also been, you know, a lack of success in some cases, which has not been because what's been prescribed has been wrong, but because I was just looking at the wrong level inside the body. And so that's, you know, that's really also helped to drive my understanding of the kind of metaphysical side of things, and the conscious and the emotion side of things, emotion being energy in motion, all that stuff, so that I can really help to clear. And, you know, that now we're starting to make progress with some of those patients who I was kind of I was not really succeeding with early on with the usual things, because, you know, the light, water, magnetism will only take you so far. There is a whole lot of patients who will not benefit purely from light, water, and magnetism. They need all this other understanding and sensitivity and consideration around emotion and consciousness and the soul, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. And that's a very transparent of you to say. And I feel like it's very important to say, because there's a lot of, with each paradigm of healing, whether it's just diet, you know, carnivore, all that, quantum biology is its own paradigm. There's always this group that doesn't get the success, that doesn't heal. And we can't just not look at them and pretend that that didn't happen, and look at the 80% success rate or whatever and focus on that. We cover all our bases. We examine that as well. Not every paradigm is a smashing hit, although there's varying degrees. But yeah, you, as a result, looked deeper. And as a result, you combined dimensions and used them at the same time, put in all the levels together. And if you put in all those levels together, you will cover the widest, right? And you saw your success rate increase with that.
Yeah, it was distressing initially. It was like, what am I doing wrong? I've learned all these things, and sometimes they work, sometimes they don't work. But, you know, the greatest health clinicians are the ones that will learn from their patients, because the patients will always give us the clue about how to help them. We just have to open the ears and open our hearts and listen.
Well, As this interview is wrapping up, I wanna get an insight as to, you know, what your process, because you said in your Instagram post that your 2023 key lesson was that all disease starts at the soul level, right? Give us an insight to how that process unfolded for you that year, what that's looking like moving forward into 2024 and beyond, as how you are as a person showing up with your friends and family and people, and as a physician showing up with your patients, and the importance of that lesson to spread that message as well.
Yeah, sure. So I came to that through understanding. It was through reading, it was through clinical experience with patients and clients, and that was kind of like the big shift forward for me. Some of my things were not working, and that was holding up progress for my patients. So I had to dig deep. I had to research. I had to read to understand. And that really took me down the metaphysical route. It was also me going to Mecca in April, which was a key kind of change in my life in April 2023, a big shift. going back to source for Muslims getting the download there. How does that translate into my day to day? I feel that I project a lot more love than I ever have. Not that there was no love before, but you know, there's just more now. There's more compassion. There's more understanding. There's more gentleness. There's the recommendations that I make to people regarding health are a lot more cognizant of where their soul is at the moment. What are they struggling with? And then finally, how does that show up with family and friends? I just love talking about all of this. So perhaps, they find me suffocating because all I want to talk about is, the different levels of the body and the metaphysical and the physical. And but I feel compelled to speak. I feel compelled to talk. I feel grateful for the knowledge that I have downloaded. And I feel grateful for the abilities that I have to express it. And I feel a compulsion to continue to speak and, to share your platform with me is I'm grateful for that. It's a thrill. I just feel one of my purposes in life is just to talk, just to continue talking, give speeches, give talks, up onto podcasts and just talk, and hopefully it resonates.
Yeah. Amazing. Can I ask you, one of the best things about coming across quantum biology is the possibility, the field has possibilities, right? But now the possibility of my children being raised right from the start has now finally opened up. And I know you have a child and you're setting them right pretty early, right? Do you notice like them being well-behaved, sharp, or just a beautiful soup of qualities within them because not only have you nourished them with love as a parent, but you set their physical environment right and made that nourishing as well? Could you speak to your experience as being a quantum parent?
Yeah, I've got two beautiful children. The problem with applying quantum biology to at home is that they have too much energy. So it's about, finding ways for them to disperse of all the energy throughout the day so that when they do lay down for bed, they fall asleep. But, I'm grateful for the health that they have. I'm grateful for the love that they bring. The other day, my son, he's fascinated by every day he asks for me to teach him something new about quantum, so he knows about DHA and he knows about sunlight, etc. The other day, he was asking me to do something and I said, I can't do it, darling. But it's just difficult for me. It was a friend of mine. He was juggling two balls just like this. And so my son asked him to juggle three balls and he's like, I can't juggle three balls. And so he said to my friend, that can't isn't a word in the quantum, world. Which I just thought was gorgeous. So he's definitely very academic about the quantum side of things, which is great. I'm grateful that my children will grow up with a firm standing in both the physical and the metaphysical. And I just want that for all children. Really, everything that I do is for the kids. It's for your future children, God willing. It's for my children. It's for everyone's children. And I'm willing to ruffle people's feathers if necessary in order to get them to think a little bit better for their children.
Yeah, no. And then you embody that possibility, being open for anybody listening to this podcast, and your son is going to be his own ripple effect. Awesome to think about in the future. And what we're doing is ultimately laying the earth in good hands. It's honestly my favorite implication of this whole thing, because if you do it right, nature herself will make a robust, good human that is so capable of so many things. Right, as a default, we've just gotten away from that possibility. And now we're tuning back into it. So yeah, I just wanted to cap. I know that's one of your, the quantum kid is one of your things, and just wanted to cap off with that. So it's been a pleasure having you on. And if you have any final words to close off, that would be lovely.
Yeah, sure. The final words for today for me is to go deep. It's to look deeper, use the sun and nature to help you find the deep blades inside of you and heal from the inside out. And what you have on the other side is absolute bliss. It's hard. Healing is hard. It definitely is. There's always pain. There's always discomfort. But as I said, on the other side, it's absolute bliss. It's worth it. And not only will you benefit, but your children will as well.
Well said. Thank you so much for coming on the show. And I'm glad to have brought out this side of you that speaks more about both dimensions of reality and putting forth that side of you out there for people to hear. So thank you so much for expressing yourself in that way. Thank you so much for your time and energy. And I'll see you guys back next time on the Guiding Lighthouse podcast.